This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at the public backlash to Donald Trump's executive order protecting the nation from foreign terrorist entry. The order's stated policy is to protect the country from foreign nationals who intend to commit terrorist attacks. Joining us to explain this executive order is Trina Rael Muto, litigation director at the National Immigration Project in Boston. New York University professor Hunt Alcott joins us to talk about a recent study he and a colleague authored on fake news.
Are people influenced by fake news? We think not.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, our listeners may recall that a few years ago, the Center for Constitutional Rights was representing the father of Anwar al-Awlaki. They actually got an injunction to try to prevent his assassination, which had been announced in advance. And subsequently, his son was killed, then his grandson, and more recently, his granddaughter in a drone strike.
Yeah, this was one of the last pieces of litigation that Michael Ratner was involved in. The Obama administration announced in advance that it was going to murder Anwar al-Awlaki, who was this fiery Muslim cleric doing a lot of anti-American propaganda. The center was retained by Anwar al-Awlaki's father, and the center went into court arguing that you can't assassinate an American citizen on the whim of the executive, that it lacks due process. You can't do that. And the center was thrown out of court on the grounds that it lacked standing. The father lacked standing, and the son was subsequently killed in a drone strike. 2 weeks later.
And this was in 2011.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then 2 weeks later, Al-Awlaki's son, 16-year-old boy, was at a cafe.
Also an American citizen.
Also an American citizen, born in New Mexico. And the son was killed. And then 2 weeks ago, Al-Awlaki's 8-year-old daughter, Nora, was killed in Yemen in that attack, another drone attack that the Trump administration initiated. It was the first drone strike approved by Trump. They killed some 30 women and children, claimed a success. So the end of the story is that both the father and the son and the daughter were all killed in an American drone strike. Trump, interestingly, admitted to Bill O'Reilly that, yes, indeed, America does assassinate people.
And just to note that in June 2014, a memorandum that had been previously classified and issued by the U.S. Department of Justice was released, and that memo justified al-Awlaki's death as a lawful act of war. But we would, of course, classify it as an extrajudicial execution, as you've said.
We have something to play for our audience. It's a 3-minute talk by the great attorney William Kunstler. Just on that point, Heidi, that regimes like the Trump regime or the regime in fascist Germany always try to do what they do under color of law. Every gold tooth that was taken out of the skull of every Jew in those concentration camps was done under color of law. They were all marked down in a book. It was all regular. Before Trump gave the order for the drone assassination that killed this 8-year-old girl, the Office of Legal Counsel approved of it. This is all done legally. This is the way these oppressive regimes work. They try to mask what they're doing with the legitimacy that it's done under the color of law. And that's the point that Bill Kunstler is going to make in this clip.
Let's have a listen.
And that's the terrible myth of organized society, that everything that's done through the established system is legal. And that word has a powerful psychological impact. It makes people believe that there is an order to life and an order to a system, and that a person that goes through this order and is convicted has gotten all that is due him. And therefore, society can turn its conscience off and look to other things and other times. And that's the terrible thing about these past trials, is that they have this aura of legitimacy, this aura of legality. I suspect that better men than the world has known, and more of them, have gone to their death through a legal system than through all the illegalities in the history of man. 6 million people in Europe during the Third Reich, legal. Sacco Vanzetti, quite legal. The Haymarket defendants, legal. The hundreds of rape trials throughout the South, where black men were condemned to death, all legal. Jesus, legal. Socrates, legal. And that is the kaleidoscopic nature of what we live through here and in other places. Because all tyrants learn that it is far better to do this thing through some semblance of legality than to do it without that pretense.
Public backlash to Donald Trump's executive order protecting the nation from foreign terrorist entry has been fast and furious. The order's stated policy is to protect the country from foreign nationals who intend to commit terrorist attacks in the United States. It directs the Secretary of State and the Director of National Intelligence to determine what information is needed from any country to decide if one of its nationals seeking admission is who he or she claims to be and does not pose a security or a public safety threat. It gives them 30 days to report the results of that determination with a list of countries that do not hand over adequate information. The executive order imposes a 90-day suspension of immigrant and non-immigrant admission of aliens from countries designated in Section 217.112 of the Immigration and Nationality Act, which excludes aliens who have been present in a specified country from participating in the visa waiver program. Joining us to explain this executive order and what immigrant rights organizations are doing on their behalf is Trina Rael Muto, litigation director at the National Immigration Project in Boston. Trina's work focuses on litigation before the federal courts on issues related to removal defense and government accountability. Previously, she wrote amicus briefs and practice advisories for the American Immigration Council. Trina, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Were you and your colleagues at the Immigration Project surprised by Donald Trump's executive order? And if not, why not?
Were we surprised? No. For months leading up to the election, we watched Trump campaign on anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, anti-women rhetoric. He told his supporters that he was going to increase deportation, to build a wall that was going to be funded by Mexico. He said derogatory things about Mexican people, and he vowed to set up a, quote, total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States. And so I don't think we were surprised by the order. We knew it was coming, but I do think we were a bit surprised by the shock and awe tactics that came out of the first couple of days of the administration, because it's not just this one executive order. There was actually three executive orders that he issued. He issued two on January 25th. One was about interior enforcement, basically punishing sanctuary cities and ordering the hiring of more immigration or enforcement officers, more state and local cooperation with the federal government. And he issued a second one about exterior enforcement, which called for the construction of a massive wall along the Mexican border, and asked to expand the detention capacity in the U.S. at the border and to limit the use of parole. I think that we got sort of the 1-2-3 punch, and we saw some things happening in the administration afterwards. We saw senior State Department officials resign. We saw the Border Patrol chief resign. And then after we got this, quote, so-called terrorism protection executive order, we saw the acting attorney general say she wouldn't enforce it, and the president firing her. And chaos really started to break out in response to what is most commonly known in the media as the Muslim travel ban. To answer a question, we weren't surprised. I think the speed has been challenging, and it sort of feels like we're living in a season of that television show 24, where sort of every hour is suspenseful, and we're just sort of waiting for, you know, what the next thing that's going to happen, how it plays out in the legal landscape.
Good analogy. Now, referring to that so-called Muslim travel ban, many are calling Trump's actions unlawful. But just to play devil's advocate here, doesn't the president have the authority to declare such suspensions under the Immigration and Nationality Act?
Yes. I mean, the statute does give the president authority to suspend entries, but the National Immigration Project, along with the ACLU, along with our allies and other groups, are all arguing to the court that that statutory authority is still subject to other statutory and constitutional limits. For example, the president couldn't invoke that statute to ban all women from entering the United States or all people with blue eyes from entering the United States. And as a practical and a historical point, no president has ever invoked this authority under 212F of the Immigration and Nationality Act to authorize such a broad and discriminatory nationality-based and religious-based suspension on entries. By our calculation, there have been over 40 instances where presidents have used this statutory authority to suspend entries, but in all 40 instances, the president's proclamation has been tailored to address specific individuals whose entry would be inconsistent with U.S. foreign policy interests. While it's true that the president has the authority, the issue here is how he has invoked it. He has banned nationals from seven countries, and all seven of those countries are predominantly Muslim countries.
I wanted to ask you about that and also about the significance of the fact that none of the people who have come in as refugees or visitors from any of those seven countries from 1975 to year 2015, none of them have committed any terrorist acts. What's the significance of that?
What is the significance of that? Well, that's an interesting question, and it's a question that is playing out in the courts right now. How the government has identified these seven countries is a bit unclear. And what's interesting about the executive order and how it's playing out in the courts is there is no evidence, and the government has put forward no evidence, that the U.S. consulates and the embassies in these seven countries, in some of these seven countries, people process at a neighboring country, at a neighboring consulate or embassy. But there's no evidence that our State Department is not applying the rigorous criteria for vetting individuals in a less safe manner than all the rest of the embassies and consulates in the rest of the world. And I would also point out, Michael, in your noting about these seven countries, that none of the 9/11 attackers came from these seven countries.
That's right. 15 of 19 of them came from Saudi Arabia, which is not on the list.
Right.
Trina, on Saturday, January 28th, a Brooklyn federal judge granted an emergency stay request to bar the deportation of people from those seven countries who had landed in the U.S. after the EO was issued. And this included refugees, students, immigrants, and non-immigrants, visa holders. Can you tell us what happened after that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I mean, and let me start a little bit by getting to what happened before that. I mean, as your question contemplates, what happens is that this order is signed on in the evening of a Friday night, where people from these seven countries were already in the air when the order was signed or had boarded flights to the U.S. And what happened is they were arriving in the United States, and they were being detained in the airports. And the Customs and Border Patrol officers were forcing some of these individuals to sign papers to withdraw their requests to come to the United States and forcing them to get back on planes. And so what we saw happen was we saw the left mobilize. We saw progressives mobilize. We saw legal workers, law students, attorneys, just members of the general public say, hey, this isn't right, and protest at the airport and take to the streets. And so this case in Brooklyn that was brought by the ACLU and its allies first, it basically is a perfect example of the chaos. We had Mr. Darwish, who was an Iraqi national who had worked for the U.S. military abroad, put his life on the line for the U.S. military abroad. He's one of these individuals who was on the plane. He arrived in the United States. He was detained at JFK Airport. And so this lawsuit was filed in Brooklyn asking the district court judge to stop deporting people back to these seven countries. But that lawsuit, I think, was filed in the morning, and we don't get the order staying the deportation until the evening. So during Saturday, last Saturday, basically the whole country is mobilizing, and other lawsuits are being filed on behalf of detained individuals. And we get the news that the court grants the stay nationwide, which is wonderful. It was a great first step in the triage to the damage caused by this order. But this doesn't stop the problem. What we then see is that people cannot board flights, and they were either stranded abroad, separated from their families, some in these third countries where they had processed for their immigrant visas. And the U.S. government basically stopped processing all visa applications for folks who are nationals of these countries. And that created a lot of hardship for a lot of people.
On Monday, January 30th, the National Immigration Project filed a lawsuit on behalf of people in the immigrant visa process. Can you tell us about that, please?
Sure. After that stay was granted, and as a result of some of that separation that we were seeing, we were hearing heartbreaking stories of families who had been separated. And so the National Immigration Project teamed up with the Northwest Immigrants' Rights Project and the American Immigration Council to file a lawsuit challenging the ban on entry as it applied to individuals who are in the immigrant visa process. That is the process whereby individuals come to the United States to reside permanently in the United States and be, quote, green card holders. And so we brought this suit on behalf of three parents and their children, each of their children, a U.S. citizen mother and her six-year-old Somali son, a U.S. citizen Yemeni's father and his 12-year-old daughter, and a lawful permanent resident Syrian mother on behalf of her 16-year-old son. And what we argued in this lawsuit was that the executive order has meant that these children could not board flights or enter the United States, and that their immigrant visas were now were suspended for 90 days, but potentially indefinitely suspended. And so we asked the court last week to certify a class, and on Monday we asked the court for a preliminary injunction, just sort of relief to suspend the operation of this executive order, in part because the current nationwide injunction, which I'll get to in a minute, is now on appeal and making its way through the courts. So that's what National Immigration Project did immediately as a result of the executive order.
And Trina, we do want to get to that nationwide injunction, but first I want to ask you, and thank you so much for going over all these cases. There have been so many. What about the lawsuit brought by the state of Washington to enjoin the executive order?
Right. And so that is the lawsuit that everybody in the immigration community is watching with bated breath. On the same day that we filed our lawsuit, which was placed before Judge Robart, the state of Washington filed a lawsuit, which also got placed before Judge Robart in the Western District of Washington, which is in Seattle. And the state of Washington also asked the district court judge to enjoin the order, with respect to its suspension on entries and with respect to its suspension on the refugee process. And the district court judge had a hearing last Friday. He heard from the state and he heard from the federal government. And at the conclusion of that hearing, he ordered what's called a temporary restraining order. So he said, stop, federal government. You can no longer implement certain portions of the executive order, which meant that things had to go back to the way they were. And so that's what happened on February 3rd. The government was forbidden from suspending entries of those seven nationals. It was forbidden from stopping the processing of their visa applications, and it was forbidden from suspending entries of refugees and refugee processing.
How did Trump and the government react to Judge Robart's order?
They were not happy, really not happy about the order. I think people probably have seen the president's attacks on the judge, calling him a, quote, so-called judge. The next day, they filed an appeal to the Ninth Circuit. So because Seattle sits within the jurisdiction of the Ninth Circuit, they filed an appeal, and they also filed a request to stay the temporary restraining order, basically asking the Ninth Circuit to let their program go forward. And so what we saw happen was, again, a massive mobilization of lawyers and law firms and technology companies and academics, all sort of filing. The list of amicus briefs that have been filed at the Ninth Circuit is lengthy. And because this is such an emergency-type motion, the Ninth Circuit then set a briefing schedule, gave the government a chance to file a brief, and gave the state of Washington, which had been joined by the state of Minnesota, a chance to file a brief. And last night, East Coast time, 3 o'clock West Coast time, the Ninth Circuit held a telephonic argument. It was streamed on the Ninth Circuit's website and picked up by several media outlets. So you had three judges on the telephone, the state of Washington Solicitor General in Seattle, and a federal government attorney, a special counsel in Washington, D.C., having this a little over an hour oral argument on the telephone about the parties standing to bring the suit, about the scope of the injunction. And at the conclusion, the Ninth Circuit said the case had been taken under submission and that they would be issuing a ruling as soon as possible. And so we expect this week for there to be a ruling in that case.
Just to clarify, by the time this interview airs, we may have a decision. Trina, what will the Ninth Circuit's ruling mean for people from those seven countries? Can they enter the United States?
Okay, that's a great question. So if the Ninth Circuit upholds the temporary restraining order, then people will be able to continue to enter the United States as they have been doing since Judge Robart issued his temporary restraining order last Friday. If the Ninth Circuit reverses that ruling, then we go back into a state of chaos whereby people are going to get caught on flights, not be able to board flights. Refugees are going to be stuck overseas. And so It could go either way, but I will tell you this. No matter what happens with the Ninth Circuit, if the government loses, they have stated in no uncertain terms that they will take the case up to the Supreme Court.
Well, that was my next question. Is it possible? I'm assuming that we're going to win in the Court of Appeals. On that assumption, then, is it possible that the case gets sent up to the Supreme Court before Trump's latest appointee, Neil Gorsuch, when he gets on, we lose a vote? So is it possible to get this thing to the Supreme Court before that man gets on the Supreme Court? Then there would be a 4-4 decision, and the lower court would be upheld, and we would have won. What's your thinking
right
on that?
Well, I mean, you know, it's hard to predict Supreme Court actions, but in all likelihood, because the Trump administration is so gung-ho to get this ban reinstated, to the extent that they quickly file an appeal to the Supreme Court, it would go to first to, depending on the nature of it, Justice Kennedy is the sitting justice that rules on emergency motions that come out of the Ninth Circuit. So he would look at that, likely refer it to the full court, as has happened before, and the court would then decide whether to take it. It is possible, very possible, that the court will take it because it's such a huge constitutional issue and has the country in such a state of chaos. So I do think it's extremely possible. And then you just have to juxtapose that against the Gorsuch confirmation process and how long, you know, that is going to take and how long the Democrats can push back on that. So I think it's possible, and certainly from our standpoint, we think we might do better on a 4-4 with an 8-judge panel. Personally, I can't speak for everyone.
Right. Trina, is the National Immigration Project involved in any other litigation challenging this executive order?
Yes. Thanks for that question. We are also engaged in litigation that deals with Section 4 of the executive order. We had actually filed a lawsuit after the inauguration, but before the issuance of the executive orders, challenging this process, this sort of secret and unlawful government vetting process that targets applications for immigration benefits for either delay or denial. It seeks to delay and deny based on criteria that's not in the Immigration and Nationality Act, based on a program that Congress has not sanctioned or approved. It's sort of the sub-regulatory process known as CARP. That stands for the Controlled Application Review and Resolution Program. And so we had filed that, and then when the executive order came out in Section 4 called for this extreme vetting of people who were entering the United States fraudulently to cause harm or who potentially could cause harm after they enter the United States. I mean, that's really broad criteria. I mean, what's to say, you know, what a person's life is going to become after they enter the United States? We amended our complaint in that Wagafe case, which is also in Seattle, and we basically said you can't have these vetting programs that are not sanctioned by Congress, that are not public, that are secretive, and, you know, in this instance, to the extent that the executive order calls for a further program, we would say is overbroad and irrational, and et cetera. So we do have that lawsuit going as well, and we're moving for class certification later this week in that case.
Trina, we touched on this a little earlier when we spoke about the fact that there haven't been any so-called terrorist actions in the last 4 decades by individuals who have come to this country. What do you say, though, simply to supporters of Trump who claim that with this executive order, he is just trying to keep us safe? And what do you think is the best way to accomplish this goal?
So that's a really great question. I think there are going to be some folks for whom the facts will resonate. The facts that Michael and you both have pointed out about, hey, there have been no horrible acts by folks from these 7 countries. So how is this keeping us safe? And for whom the fact that none of these countries had, you know, people who were involved in the 9/11 attacks. So there may be folks that sort of on the common sense level, factual level, see that. But I do think, too, that there is sort of a lack of education about the extremely rigorous standards and process that the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security already have in place, right? So we have to have faith in those institutions that they are and have been, creating a process for all this time since 9/11 that has, you know, kept the nation relatively safe. And I think we have to remind people that a month ago, nobody was thinking that individuals from these six nations, or, you know, there's certainly less attention. There wasn't this air of hysteria about, oh my gosh, we're going to be subtly attacked. This is sort of created by the administration as a type of fear-mongering hysteria, I think. And so, I mean, the way to move forward is the way to move forward as we do in all, you know, aspects. We need to talk to them. We need to reach out to them. We need to make our viewpoint understood, and we need to sort of explain the process and address, you know, the fears and concerns that they're having.
Trina, how can people learn more about the work of the Immigration Project?
So we are a membership organization of lawyers, legal workers, advocates, community organizers, and so one way to learn about us is to join us. We have a website, nationalimmigrationproject.org. We send out newsletters. We have a membership meeting at the National Lawyers Guild Convention every year. We work with several different partners within the National Lawyers Guild itself, and we are always looking for you know, to bring new folks into the fold, to hear about our work, to help us in our work, and for us to be able to assist our members, many of whom are the individuals on the ground who are doing the hard work and representing folks that are affected by not just this executive order, but the administration, you know, all the administration policies, and those members really do need support in the work that they're doing because they really are in the trenches.
Trina, we just have a minute left, but before we let you go, we have a personal question. You began your career with one of our favorite law firms in California, working with longtime Guild member Mark Vanderhout. How did you become interested in immigration issues?
So I was introduced to the Guild. Everybody is Mark Vanderhout is one of everybody's favorite immigration lawyers. I was introduced to the Guild in law school. I did a summer project working with farm workers in Virginia with the Guild my first summer. And those farm workers, a lot of them were from El Salvador and Guatemala, and they were talking to me about this case called ABC-ABC, which was a national class action that Mark Vanderhout brought on behalf of these folks in the 80s. And I had looked it up. I learned a little bit about him, and I said, okay, I really want to work for him. I had Arthur Kanoy, another great Guild lawyer, people's lawyer, come speak at our law school. And I told him, oh, it's my dream to work for this guy. And he said, oh, Mark Vanderhout, I know him. And so I had Arthur Kanoy write me a recommendation letter to Mark Vanderhout and had the pleasure of being a summer intern at what was then Vanderhout and Bregagliano and is now Vanderhout Bregagliano at Nightingale. And, you know, if anybody had a little bit of interest in immigration law before going in to work at that law firm and to work with Mark, I mean, there's just no way you can't have an interest afterwards. He is captivating, and his brain is amazing. And so I consider myself sort of one of a whole cadre of lawyers who have been trained by Mark the immigration world.
Well, Trina, Mark has trained you very well. And now that we know you also have an Arthur Kanoy connection, that's really put a place in our heart.
We've been speaking with attorney Trina Riamoto, who's the litigation director at the National Immigration Project. Get your pens. That's nationalimmigrationproject.org. Get on their website, sign up, join them. Trina, it's been a real pleasure talking to you and knowing that somebody with your passion and skills is on our side. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
The 2016 presidential race was riddled with controversies, perhaps none more relentless than that of so-called fake news. A recent study reveals that fabricated news stories were viewed by only a small percentage of Americans and were likely not as influential in the election outcome as has been suggested. This comes as Facebook and other social media sites have been criticized for permitting made-up stories to be shared on their platforms. Economists Hunt Alcott of New York University and Matthew Genskow of Stanford have released their findings in the report Social Media and Fake News in the 2016 Election. Joining us today is Hunt Alcott, Associate Professor of Economics at New York University and Research Associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He is a scientific director of Ideas 42, a think tank that applies insights from psychology and economics to business and policy design problems. Professor Alcott, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
I had never heard of the term fake news until our recent election. When did the concept of fake news originate?
It depends how you define fake news. So I think one of the things that's interesting is that the concept of a falsehood or a statement that may or may not be correct or a conspiracy theory obviously goes back a long way. And in the paper we worked on, we actually take pains to document this and show that polling data shows that many people have believed various conspiracy theories over the last 50 years. I think the term fake news, it has become more popular very recently, maybe around the time that you discovered it, and so we're using it to really apply to stories that are spread on social media that are intentionally fabricated.
Now, is there a standard or a measure of how to assess whether something is, quote, fake? Does a certain percentage of the story need to be inaccurate, for example?
We didn't actually, as researchers and working on this study, we didn't actually want to be in the business of answering the question that you just asked. We didn't want to be in the business of deciding what's true and what's false. And so for the purpose of our research, we actually relied on third-party fact-checking websites, PolitiFact.com, Snopes.com, and there are others as well, FactCheck.org. And these sites will then send researchers out to look at the facts behind some assertion and either categorize it as true or false, or in some cases, partially true.
Hunt, when and why did you decide to conduct this study on fake news? And did you have a notion that it would be a big issue in the presidential election?
We actually started this study in the week after the election. So the Monday and Tuesday after Election Day, so the next week, there were several articles in major media outlets, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, about how much fake news had circulated. And we sort of gravitated to that idea, and we wanted to benchmark, well, how much fake news was actually out there.
Talk, if you will, about your methodology. You relied on other sites to do fact-checking. Did you also read stories?
We certainly read all these stories, yes. But here was the basic methodology that we used. The bottom line question that we're asking is it possible that fake news could have affected the outcome of the election? And to answer that question, we're using a calculation, a very simple calculation that's commonly used in political science, which is what we think of as a persuasion rate. So the number of votes changed is the number of fake news articles viewed times the persuasion rate. In other words, the votes changed per article viewed. And so what we were doing in our study is to try to get a benchmark of how much fake news was out there. In other words, how many fake news articles were viewed. And then we take an outside estimate from other academic papers of persuasion rates to try to put this together and then say, well, how many votes would have been changed? And then were enough votes changed to actually impact the election?
And what was the answer?
What was the answer? So it turns out that this persuasion rate number is difficult to pin down. there are fairly good estimates of the persuasion rates for something that we thought of as being comparable to a fake news article, which is the impact of seeing one televised campaign ad on vote shares. So there's a couple of nice studies that give us this number. And then using that number, we can say that one fake news article view would have to be about 36 times more powerful at changing votes than viewing one campaign ad for fake news to have had an impact on the election.
Can you tell us how many pro-Trump fabricated stories were circulated pre-election and how many pro-Clinton fake news stories were out there?
What we did to answer that question was that we gathered a database of fake news articles from PolitiFact.com, Snopes.com, and several other sources like that. And so I can't tell you how many fake news articles were out there, but I can tell you our estimate based on these third-party assessments of what was fake. And if you rely on that, we find that there were about 30 million Facebook shares of pro-Trump fake news articles and about 7 or 8 million Facebook shares of pro-Clinton fake news articles. And when I say Facebook shares, I mean there's an article that has originated in the ether somewhere, and then it's actually shared in people's news feeds by your friends on Facebook.
Hunt, your study indicates that social media wasn't the major source of political news for most Americans in the election. How many people depend on social media for their news?
This is actually something that we really wanted to get a benchmark on. So there was a study put out by the Pew Foundation in the past year or two, which had said that 62% of Americans get news from social media. And that's a fact that comes out of their studies. But our view was that perhaps this has been misinterpreted, because even though 62% of people get news ever from social media, that doesn't mean that we get a lot of news from social media, and it doesn't mean that we believe the news that we're reading on social media as much as we believe CNN or the Wall Street Journal. And so we asked a slightly separate question, which is, what was your most important source of news during the 2016 election? And 14% of people said that social media were their most important source of news. And this was the fifth most important source of news behind network TV, local TV, cable TV, and mainstream news websites.
Professor, what do you see as the dangers of social media and fake news?
What happens on social media is that we lose a little bit of the reputation that the reputational incentives that the mainstream media sources have. So to put that differently, 15 years ago, before social media were important, we got our news from a smaller number of mainstream outlets that had serious reputations at stake. And so when they made reporting errors, if you think about the issue with Dan Rather 10 years ago, or you think about the Jason Blair episode with the New York Times, these were issues that CBS and the New York Times took very seriously when they happened, because they had reputational incentives. What happens in the social media era is that when I share a news article with my friends, I don't have so much reputation at stake. Certainly I care that my friends think I'm a serious person, but it's not like I have millions and millions of dollars at stake as a mainstream media outlet. And so I'm much more likely to share an article without really vetting or considering it. So I think that's really at the core of why we might be concerned that in a social media era, you're more likely to see news that is less reliable.
I'm curious about your background. Had you and your colleague Matthew Jensko of Stanford conducted research before related to social media or news?
The answer to that is very different for the two of us. So my background is as a behavioral economist, And actually, historically, I've been interested in understanding questions around paternalistic regulation. So if there's a, consider a government agency like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which wants to make sure that consumers aren't trapped by firms into wasting their own money, I've been interested in questions about how you make that sort of regulation. This, by contrast, Matt's work has been largely focused on the media industry, ideological segregation, and trying to understand reasons why different people pursue, different people like to consume media that is ideologically similar to them, and why different media outlets provide different types of slants. So Matt is actually much more experienced in this area than I am. Although what I think is fun is that our collaboration sort of brings to bear our different separate backgrounds.
That's interesting, and I do remember reading a few years ago how people, when they look at a newspaper, tend to seek out stories with which they, from the headlines, can tell they agree with ideologically. So we're, I guess, skewed, as in many other matters, to look for those things that don't rub us the wrong way. How can listeners learn more about your work or read this report?
Sure. The best way is probably just to Google our names, Matthew Jemsko or Hunt Alcott, and we have websites that have all of our papers listed. And then in the case of this article on fake news, it got a lot of coverage in different media outlets, and so if you just Google Alcott and Jemsko, you'll find articles that cover this particular paper.
So, Hunt, what effect do you think the Trump administration is going to have on investigating news reporters and going after the media and suppressing the free press? Is that something that we should be concerned with?
I don't. So that question is slightly outside the scope of what I've thought about. And so, you know, I am a priori always concerned that people in the media have the ability to, you know, write articles that are critical of political leaders. But I'll be watching this with a concern and interest, but I don't have any prediction as to how it's going to go. I would say that one thing that is important in this area related to the administration is that the data suggests that the Trump phenomenon is related to a general decrease in the trust of mainstream institutions such as the mass media. So there's a recent poll put out by Gallup that showed that in the early 1970s, there was quite a bit of trust among the American public in the mass media, and that has steadily declined through the 80s, 90s, 2000s through today. And at this point, we're at a place where only about half of Democrats and only 14% of Republicans say that they trust the mainstream media. So this decline in trust, I think, is quite potentially damaging to our ability as a society to come to agreement on a common set of facts.
I would agree that it's extremely troublesome, given that the free press is a cornerstone of our democracy. And I think that the timing that you just mentioned coincides with a lot of deregulation, say in the electronic media, and also, and the fact that several large corporations were then, with rules changed, allowed to own most of the media outlets across the nation. I should say it's not coincidental.
I see. Yes. Yeah. So those things certainly happened at the same time or over the same period, this deregulation and the decline in trust of mainstream media. I'd be interested to do a study on whether those were causally related. I think here I would also add that it's not just the mainstream media that is seeing a decline in trust. When you look at the polling data, there's a broader decline in trust of all institutions. And so that suggests that media deregulation might not be the whole story. There's another separate issue in the data, which I think is a little more speculative, but also interesting, which is that when you look at the Gallup polls, in every election year, 2000, 2004, 2008, 2012, there tends to be a dip in trust in the mainstream media. And this is certainly not the first year that politicians have said that the media are biased. And I wonder if that's a consistent thing that we're seeing in every election year, that people start to really question the news that they're getting.
That's interesting.
One other thing that I would mention, and it's not a direct result of the research, but it's more sort of how I've learned more broadly from this research. So what I say is the following. As part of doing this research, I've actually needed to read a much wider variety of outlets than I used to read. So before, I had a steady news diet of two or three sites that I thought were pretty reliable and that delivered information that was pretty closely consistent with my view of the world. And what's been interesting and fun and even scary as I've done this research with Matt is that I've needed to branch out and start reading other outlets just to, as part of the research. And so I've been reading outlets that I really disagreed with. And this, it turns out, has been really useful for me because certainly I'm much better informed about how others in America view the world, and I think that per se is really helpful. But what's also been interesting and honestly a little scary is that I think I'm actually much better informed about the facts as a result of reading heavily partisan websites, because what I've realized is that the sites that I was reading, which were mainstream sites, did have subtle filters on the facts that I wasn't really seeing. And so the message that I would take away and that I would encourage your listeners to think about is take a week, and if you're a liberal, read Breitbart for a while. And if you're a conservative, read the Huffington Post for a while. And you're going to disagree with a lot of stuff, but you'll come to a better sense of how everyone else thinks, and you might actually, in the long run, change your habits, because at least in my case, I feel like it's helped me learn the facts better.
I think that's excellent advice. Hunt Alcott, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you today, and we look forward to checking in with you on future studies you may be doing.
Great. Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Hunt. Take it easy.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Like a tree planted by the water.